Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Tampa, Orlando, all over Florida. Fly me.
I'm National Fly Me.
That was the soundtrack to a 1972 television ad for the now defunct National Airlines. Not much subtle about it, was there? The ad featured a series of young, attractive women beckoning passengers to come on and fly me.
From the beginning of commercial air travel in this country, airlines featured attractive women as hostesses in the sky, creating an inviting environment for the key demographic, the male business traveler. While the image in popular culture was one of glamour, the reality of the job was that it was hard work with low pay. The requirements imposed by the airline on the almost exclusively female flight attendants, or stewardesses as they were then called, were breathtaking in their scope and sexism. But over many years, the flight attendants banded together to fight for improved pay and working conditions. The story of that fight is laid out in Nell McShane Wolfhart's new book, The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. We are lucky to have Ms. Wolfhart grounded with us this morning to talk to us about her new book. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, I've been a travel journalist for many years, and I think every journalist is always sort of fishing around for potential book ideas. I discarded many over the years, but when I heard about this story, it ticked a lot of boxes for me. It's about feminism, it's about labor, which are two of my main interests, and it's about flight attendants, which I think everyone is just a little bit fascinated by. So I knew this was the one, and I think I spent about 3 years doing the research and the interviews and the writing, all told.
The book opens with a chapter entitled Honey Buns on the Charm Farm. Can you describe for the audience a bit about the American Airlines training school in the early 1960s and the experiences of women who went through the program?
The training school was a really amazing place. It was 5 acres, there was a pool, there were dormitories, and every aspiring flight attendant would come and spend 6 full weeks there training. And, you know, they would learn things about emergency evacuations and safety procedures, but most of the time was actually spent on hair, makeup, uniform, how to polish your nails. That's why it was called, in for many people, including the stewardesses themselves, the Charm Farm. And the Honey Buns refers to just like, that was another nickname for the stewardesses who were there. So it was a place where you could train to be a stewardess, and after that you'd be sent off to your base and you'd start working, but not until you'd, you know, got the appropriate hairstyle and they made sure that you were looking just right.
You know, the book had some observations that made it kind of sound like an inverted edition of the Navy's sort of flight school, and that people were getting washed out for minor infractions. to talk a little bit about the kind of reasons why people would come back and their roommate's bed would be empty.
Yeah, it was very easy to be sent home from the Charm Farm. And part of that is because being a stewardess was a really exclusive job. You know, women all over the country wanted to be stewardesses because their other options were maybe become a nurse, become a teacher, maybe you could be a man's secretary, but there just weren't that many choices. And stewardess was fully like an exclusive job. You could fly around the world, you could live this incredibly glamorous lifestyle, you could get out of your small town. So it was really hard to get into the Charm Farm, and they also had the ability to send anyone home for the tiniest infraction because there were women lining up to take that person's place. So it would be something as silly as like talking back to one of the instructors, or, you know, putting on the wrong makeup, or, you know, taking leave, coming back maybe an hour after curfew. The infractions were tiny, and then you'd just be sent home immediately and someone else would come replace you.
We opened the interview. I mean, you heard the way we opened the interview with an excerpt from the National Fly Me ad campaign, which you talk about in the book as one being particularly offensive to many of the flight attendants. But can you describe for the audience a little bit about how the airlines used flight attendants in their advertising campaigns in the 60s and 70s? Because, you know, looking back at some of the pictures you have in the book, those ads were breathtaking.
I think the ads were one of my favorite parts of the book. They were one of the most interesting things to research. I mean, they're just jaw-dropping to look at them from the perspective of 2022. And there's actually a shift that you can track if you look at airline ads in those decades. In the 60s, the ads were all about how the stewardesses were on board to take care of the passengers. There was one that said, "Think of her as your mother." And it was all of the copy of the ad was all about how she'll bring you a cool drink and a soft pillow. All she wants is for you to be happy and relaxed and taken care of. And they were sort of demure, but the way they portrayed the stewardesses were just like, they are there to make sure that every man is just like coddled like a baby. And then as we get into the 70s and there's more of a sexual revolution taking place and women's liberation becomes more of a mainstream thing, the ads go the other way and they make these women into really flying Playboy bunnies. Like, they're highly sexualized. They're wearing tiny uniforms. The uniforms get tinier with each year. And one of the ads, I think, that was the most infuriating to the stewardesses was this Flyme ad that you played. They used real working stewardesses for these ads. The pictures you would see in the ads were of real women. So it would say, "Flyme, I'm Cheryl," or "Flyme, I'm Linda." And you'd be looking at, you know, the real Cheryl or the real Linda. And one of my favorite parts of the book comes when there's a group, a fabulous group organized in New York called Stewardesses for Women's Rights. And this has the most beautifully 1970s name of anything I've ever come across. But they are all about, you know, getting more rights for women in the cabin. And they got out and they picketed the offices of the ad agency that had come up with the Flyme campaign because they hated it. It was so demeaning. It was so sexist. And some of the ads that they, you know, they held up picket signs and they'd say things like, you know, "Go fly yourself." And then the owner of the ad agency, this is an extra part, the owner of the ad agency, his name was Bill Free, he came out to try and, you know, calm them down, and he handed out red roses to these women who were picketing. So they went home and they made new signs, and now the sign said, "I'm Bill, fire me."
I can't resist asking you about another ad campaign that you couldn't capture on the radio, which is the Braniff campaign. Talk to us a little bit about those ads and the visuals on them.
Okay, so Braniff they really launched the whole like sex object in the sky trend, and their campaign was called The Airstrip. So not subtle at all. And it was basically predicated on the idea that the stewardesses on your plane would begin the flight by wearing, you know, uniforms topped by coats and whatever, scarves. And then as the flight went on, they would gradually remove items of clothing. They'd take off a scarf, they'd remove a coat, maybe they'd unwrap a skirt to reveal a mini skirt. It was this sort of like slow, titillating promise that they were trying to sell to these male business passengers who were definitely their target audience.
Well, that's right where I was going to go is, you know, their target audience is male business passengers. But technically, did they need this kind of marketing? I mean, weren't these guys going to fly anyway?
They were definitely going to fly anyway, but the proliferation of airlines meant that they were all competing for the same market share. And the airlines loved to try to differentiate themselves. You know, after, you know, everyone had the same destinations and their safety records were all the same, the only way that they could really separate, you know, the appeal of TWA from American Airlines was through the stewardesses. So they went hard on, you know, coming up with these uniforms. I think my favorite was Southwest, which was a pair of orange hot pants and white lace-up go-go boots. So they, you know, and they each actually hired women based on the kind of look that they were adopting for their campaigns. So the stewardesses were really, really like a strong marketing tool for the airlines.
You know, it's one thing to look back at those ads and think about how outrageous they were, but, you know, another aspect that I think you touched on in the book was the notion that when this kind of marketing is held out for these airlines, to what extent did the advertising itself contribute to poor treatment of the flight attendants by crews and by other passengers?
It was a big contributor. Stewardesses were never getting them, you know, the respect they deserved as safety professionals, or, you know, even from the beginning of stewardesses. But these ads, like, the airlines were literally selling them as sex objects. So, like, even their employers didn't respect them. So the passengers definitely didn't respect them. And We know when you're wearing these uniforms, which got progressively smaller and also sillier. American Airlines at one point had a tartan skirt, a tartan vest, and like a raccoon skin cap. It was a sort of Daniel Boone frontier look. And when you're trying to give a safety lecture to passengers and tell them where the emergency exit are, you know, exits are, then it's a little hard to do that and not feel goofy. And the passengers, when especially when these sexist ads really started ramping up, I mean, they would just leer and grope. They would say, oh, can I fly you today, baby? And there wasn't that much the stewardesses could do about it.
Unbelievable. The book tells the story of progress in the working conditions of flight attendants by following the careers of a few individuals. Who is Pat Gibbs, and why did you choose to focus on her?
My book follows two stewardesses who kind of embody different, I would say, like labor ideas or different ideas, but they were both looking for the same thing, which was increased rights for working stewardesses. Pat Gibbs was my star character because she's still alive, by the way. She's almost 80 years old. She lives in Texas. She was a woman who grew up in small towns in the U.S. She became a stewardess in 1962, and her only ambition in life was to become a stewardess supervisor. You know, to become a manager at American Airlines. That's what she wanted. That was all she wanted. And then as she realized how ridiculous some of these, you know, rules were, how sexist they were, how the working conditions were really terrible for these women, like she was, radicalized, to use kind of a strong word, but she basically became a militant labor leader and a union president. And she was somebody who led stewardesses in the most, you know, powerful, strong, loud-mouthed way to independence and to more rights. And it was that transformation, I think, that was so interesting for me, because if the working conditions had been better, this would never have happened. She would just have gone on to become a stewardess supervisor. But the companies literally created the conditions for her to become a unionist.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about her and how she eventually collides with, I believe, Tommy Hutto Blake. I think is that pronounced right?
Hutto Blake.
Hutto
yes.
Blake. Yes. But I want to go back to some of those working condition issues that were so surprising. There were some bizarre and very onerous requirements that were imposed on the flight attendants. Things like makeup requirements, weight limits, the pregnancy ban, the marriage ban, and something called a girdle check. Can you flesh out a little bit about what some of those things were?
Sure. The girdle check was exactly what it sounds like. Through the 60s, girdles were a required part of the uniform, and any supervisor, even a pilot, was allowed to sort of run their hand over your butt to make sure that you were wearing the girdle. There were other requirements just to get the job. You had to have even teeth, clear skin. You couldn't wear glasses. Most of the time you had to be white. That was an unspoken rule. And then once you got the job, you had to, yes, have perfect hair in the hairstyle that the airline had designated, perfect makeup. You couldn't have a chip in your nail polish. Your weight was highly regulated. The airlines had weight limits that were based on height. So you weren't allowed to exceed the maximum weight allowed for your height. And if you gained like a couple of pounds, you could be pulled off the flight right then and there. I think the worst part of that was that for many airlines, there was a scale in the middle of operations. And operations is just a part of the airport where, you know, the pilots and the flight attendants and the managers all work and meet. But like, you could be pulled onto the scale in the middle of this bustling area and weighed at any time. And then, of course, it was pretty easy to lose the job. If you got married, you would be fired. If you got pregnant, you would be fired. And if you had managed to avoid either of those things, you would be fired when you turned 32.
You know, one of the things that really caught my eye was this notion of the age limitation as a means of controlling the flight attendants from a management perspective. In other words, if someone knew that they would only be there a maximum of a few years, they weren't likely to really invest in trying to create better working conditions. Can you flesh that out a little?
That's exactly right. Like, these restrictions were twofold. One, it kept the workforce looking young and conventionally attractive, which, as we discussed, was a really big marketing marketing tool for them. And also, when you know you're just going to be in a job for a few years, and a lot of these women, I mean, they were there for less than 3 years. I think at one point, 80% of them were leaving after less than 3 years because they were getting married. So if there's just absolutely no incentive for you to join the union or, you know, protest these sexist rules or try to get the weight limit raised, because it's just sort of a temp job. You're there for a few years between high school or college and getting married, and then you're out of there. And of course, yeah, you're not fighting for pensions or benefits or anything like that. So it served both purposes.
Some flight attendants did take steps to get around these kind of regulations and restrictions, and the steps they took were extraordinary. Can you share the anecdote about a woman who claimed she was raising her sister's children?
This was absolutely amazing to me. So apparently up to 30% of flight attendants were secretly married. I mean, that's just a guess, obviously. It's impossible to know for sure. But because you'd be fired when you were married, many of them would get married, not tell anybody. They wouldn't put an announcement in the paper. They wouldn't wear a wedding ring to work. They would maybe have two phone lines in their home. One of them was just for the airline to call and give the schedules, and the other was for, you know, the flight attendant and her husband to use. So they jumped through a lot of hoops to keep those marriages secret. And if you had kids, I mean, it was almost impossible to get away with that. But I was told one story about a woman who's had two children in secret. She had sort of cobbled together sick leave and educational leave and had these two kids. And she made up this very elaborate backstory to explain their existence. She went around telling everybody that her best friend had been killed in a car accident. Now she and her husband were responsible for their children. She'd even like hand around photographs of the kids and talk about how she adopted them after the crash. I mean, just amazing the lengths people would go to keep these jobs.
Let's sort of shift our focus a little bit more to traditional labor management and union issues. The flight attendants were unionized. They belonged to, I think it was the Transportation Workers Union. Talk a little bit about how the union at the outset treated the women so differently than their male counterparts.
Yeah, flight attendants have been unionized really since the beginning at everywhere except Delta. And as you may know, there's a big union drive going on at Delta right now. They've never been unionized. But the flight attendants at American Airlines and at most of the other airlines had been unionized. And the flight attendants at American Airlines were affiliated, yes, to the Transport Workers Union, which most people associate with, you know, subway drivers and bus drivers and, you know, other kinds of transport workers. So they're in this union with a lot of other airline workers, including mechanics and ground crew and cleaners. And even though there are tens of thousands of flight attendants, they're kind of treated like the mascots of the labor movement. You know, they're not around for very long. They don't get paid as highly as anybody else. You know, the cleaners were paid more than them. The mechanics were paid more than them. The pilots were paid way more than them. And even though, you know, they were part of a union and they were supposed to be represented at the bargaining table, they just weren't taken seriously enough by the Transport Workers Union to ever spend like real time and energy and political capital on getting the things that they needed, or even in turning the job into a career rather than just a temp job.
And that was the fight that Pat Gibbs and Tommy sort of went into. Talk a little bit about how they tried to pressure the union to take them seriously. What tactics did they use and what worked?
This was a very long process with a lot of ups and downs, which I think is pretty common in the labor movement. It's a lot of two steps forward, one step back. But there was an effort to push the men who were representing them to take their issues more seriously. There was, in fact, a big showdown in 1976 over single rooms on layovers. And this, I think, is really interesting. Just in general with the labor movement is that the things that outsiders consider important and the things that workers consider important are often not the same things. So flight attendants had been, when they were on a layover and the airline put them up in a hotel, they always had to share rooms. Pilots didn't have to share rooms. Other men didn't have to share rooms. And once men started working as flight attendants in the early 70s, they also got their own rooms. But female flight attendants had to share. And so, you know, sometimes it would be a stranger, sometimes a person would be on the phone, or, you know, when you're trying to get a few hours sleep between flights, it is not conducive. And so they ended up making this a contract issue. And the Transport Workers Union almost refused to bring this up in contract negotiations. They said, no, like, we can fight for more pay, we can get other things for you, but this isn't important. And the flight attendants made it very clear that it was important. Like, this was a strike issue for them. And in fact, they voted down their contract two times before the transport workers finally agreed to push for the single rooms for flight attendants, and the airline agreed. So that's just one example of how, like, the things that the flight attendants wanted and the things that the transport workers union were willing to fight for them were often totally divergent.
And that set of stories about how they voted down the potential contract at first because it didn't have the single room provision, it's wonderfully dramatic in the book. I really, really enjoyed it. The other thing that I found somewhat interesting was your suggestion that one of the reasons that male flight attendants were given single rooms from the outset was a concern that so many of them were gay.
Yeah. Well, at the outset, there weren't that many of the men. So, you know, on a flight, there would usually just be one male flight attendant. And, you know, he couldn't room with a woman, so he always got his own room, even if he had no seniority. And flight attendants who had been flying for 8 years had to share rooms, you know, like kids or whatever. But yeah, there was absolutely like gay panic at the airlines that having these male flight attendants was, you know, I mean, a lot of the heads of the airlines came out and said, like, there are no gay flight attendants here. If we had gay flight attendants, we would fire them. There was, like, a real backlash that eventually partially went away, I guess we could say.
So how did the airline flight attendants come to form their own union? And is that sort of the end of the story here?
Well, I don't know if it's the end of the story. It's the end of my story.
Right.
It's where I leave the book. There's Pat Gibbs and Tommy Hutto Blake, the two flight attendants that are sort of like driving the story throughout the book. Pat is fighting for an independent union. She wants the flight attendants to leave the transport workers union because these men are not representing them. They're not getting them what they want, what they need. They're treating them like mascots. She says, like, we need to have our own independent woman-led union. And Tommy, on the other hand, she's saying, she's a union president at the time. She's saying, like, okay, it's not great, but we're with organized labor. We have access to all their resources. Like, if we just stay in here, we'll be running the damn unions. That's a direct quote. So they're both on opposite sides of this fight. And this is at the end of the book, which is where there's a big vote. There's a lot of tension. And the flight attendants, spoiler alert, vote to leave the transport workers and form their own independent women-led unions.
One thing that I had, we're getting towards the end of the interview, so, you know, I'm wrapping up on questions. I had just, you know, heard recently with regards to, you know, pay for flight attendants, that it didn't start until the door closed. Now COVID has undoubtedly made the life of flight attendants much, much more difficult. Do you feel that the flight attendants today, you know, have achieved the status and working conditions they deserve?
I think that the same ideas we have about flight attendants that came from these ads back in the 70s are still in place. Flight attendants don't get the respect that they deserve as safety professionals. Most people think of them as flying waitresses. I don't think that has really changed. And I think COVID, in fact, has made it worse with people, you know, refusing to put on their masks or getting drunk and assaulting flight attendants, all of these things. But the pay issue is also really interesting because that's true, is that flight attendants don't get paid until, you know, doors are closed. And so if you're sitting on the plane for 2 hours because there's a delay, flight attendants aren't getting paid for that time. Delta recently agreed to pay flight attendants for that time. They're the first major airline to do that. And I think it is not coincidental that there is this giant union drive going on right now at Delta, and that this, in fact, was a reaction to that.
That makes some sense.
Well, actually, I have one quick question before we go. Another extraordinary thing, and this does have to be quick. You talk about how, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the flight attendants approached the EEOC to say, hey, we're being discriminated against because of our sex. And the EEOC sort of said, that ain't our issue. Is that really what happened?
That is what happened. The EEOC was formed to deal with race. I mean, that's what everyone who worked there thought. And even though they were also, you know, supposed to deal with sex discrimination in employment, most of the people there were fully concentrated on race. But the flight attendants, they really pushed for it, and they became kind of like the leaders in sex discrimination cases, which is why their work had like repercussions for all working women in America today. Like, the work they did back then went on to establish case law that we're all benefiting from right now.
another extraordinary set of stories, the internal dynamics between the flight attendants and the EEOC. We've been talking to Nell McShane Wolfhart about her fabulous new book, The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet. We greatly enjoyed the book, and we certainly enjoyed spending our time with you this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
Hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore.
In the summer of 2011, the oil tanker Brillante Virtuoso was sailing the dangerous waters off the coast of Yemen when it was, ostensibly, attacked by pirates. But the pirates didn't seek to hold the tanker for ransom or to steal the millions of dollars in cargo it was carrying. Instead, the ship was lit ablaze, leaving its owner with a burned-out hulk and a series of insurance claims. So why would the pirates act in such an irrational fashion? That is, of course, because these pirates were no more genuine than Johnny Depp.
In fact, the story of the Brillante Virtuoso is one of international intrigue in the surprisingly corrupt world of international shipping and the insurers that make the critical business possible. The story involves murder, corruption, and a surprising lack of consequences to the wrongdoers by the international legal system. The story is laid out in detail by Bloomberg reporters Matthew Campbell and Kit Shalell in their new book, Dead in the Water. We are lucky to be able to spend some time with them this morning. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
What motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take you to research it?
Go ahead, Matt.
Well, yeah, so you have to separate our process here into two chunks. So the genesis of this book was a story we did for Bloomberg that was published in 2017 that essentially got the ball rolling and got us into this story. In what we thought at the time was a very deep way, although in fact we had no idea. Kit and I continued to keep an eye on it. There was some ongoing litigation in London that we were getting papers from. We occasionally met up with some of our key sources on the original story. And around early 2019, it just dawned on both of us that there was a larger story to tell here, not only about the incident itself and this incredible scandal, but also about the efforts to unravel it and the really heroic, in some cases, campaign by a number of very tenacious people to get to the bottom of what had occurred. And that really is what sustained the second half of the book.
Can we start with a bit of an overview? What happened on that day in 2011 when the vessel was attacked?
So this was way back in a period which was marked by heavy pirate activity off the coast of Somalia. There was a vessel attacked or an attempted attack every two or three days. And so the Brillante Virtuoso proceeded through the Suez Canal into this area that was known to be extremely dangerous. And for reasons that didn't become clear until much later, the vessel and its captain decided to stop just off the coast of Yemen, which is close to Somali waters, to wait for a security team. And so it just waited overnight, drifting with its lights on. And sure enough, at around midnight, the watchman on deck saw a small vessel approaching very fast, and it contained a number of men carrying long rifles and wearing masks. The men on the little vessel claimed to be security. But once they were aboard, they hijacked the ship, pointed guns at everyone, locked the crew in a TV room, and then eventually set off an explosion in the engine room and fled. All the sailors managed to escape. They were rescued by a U.S. naval vessel that was patrolling nearby. And the pirates disappeared into thin air. And, you know, the nature of the attack was so strange and unusual that right from the start, everyone involved had suspicions that, you know, this might not have been real pirates. They didn't behave like Somali pirates. They didn't try and ransom the vessel. They didn't try and sail it back to Somalia. They just burned it and fled. And so that set off a process, really, that is still going on to this day of trying to unravel why a ship owner or why you know, anyone would set fire to a vessel carrying 1 million barrels of oil.
Because these vessels carry so much in value, there's certain pieces that need to be put in place in order for them to even just be able to ship. And so whether they're, you know, struck by pirates or there's some other things, you know, there's a role that Lloyd's plays in Lloyd's of London plays in the world of international shipping. Let's start with first, you know, how did it become involved with the Brillante Virtuoso?
So as you can imagine, in any business like shipping, where you have these very valuable assets, in some cases carrying for the largest container vessel, $1 billion of cargo, and then hundreds of millions more in value for the ship itself, there is a need for insurance. Things go wrong at sea all the time. Shipwrecks are surprisingly common. And for about 300 years now, the place, the foremost place in the world to get shipping insurance has been Lloyd's of London, which most of us know has something to do with insurance, but in fact, contrary to popular belief, is actually not itself an insurer. It's more like a market. It's kind of a stock exchange for risk, where real insurers, Prudential, AIG, all the names we're familiar with, come to slice and dice exposure to different liabilities. And the whole goal of Lloyd's is to subdivide the risk on any one asset. So, you know, there might be 20 or 30 insurers ultimately holding the bag in the case of a big marine accident. And so the loss will not be catastrophic for any one of them. So the Brillante, like so many, and indeed the great majority of large commercial vessels, was insured at Lloyd's. And when it was virtually destroyed in the Gulf of Aden, Lloyd's had to swing into action.
And they start to swing into action because they're going to obviously be out for millions of dollars for the vessel, for the cargo. And as I understand it, there were different insurers for different pieces of this. Obviously, people want to know whether this is legitimate. So enter the role of one David Mockett. Tell us a little bit about him.
So David Mockett was a British expat who'd lived in the Middle East for much of his adult life. Most recently at the time that we write about, and living in Aden in southern Yemen, which is the main port city in Yemen. And David worked as something called a marine surveyor. And just as if you have a tree fall on your garage, the insurance company needs to send someone to check out the accident, make an estimate of the damage, make sure that the tree did actually fall on your garage. That's what David did, just on enormous scale. So he would be dispatched to vessels that had been damaged or sunk in some marine calamity, or go to check out a dock that had been crashed into, things like that, assess the damage, make sure that the story that was being told by the claimant stacked up, and then send a report off to London, and all being well, insurance claims would then be paid out. So David got the call on the Brillante. He boarded the vessel, he checked it out, went bow to stern in great detail, took a lot of notes, took a lot of photographs, and he began to think pretty much from day one, or really from hour one, that there was something off about this story. He didn't really know what it was. He didn't have any firm ideas of what it was that bothered him about it, but he did have a sense that things were not stacking up. And he expressed those doubts to others in Aden. He sent reports up to London that were being circulated widely within the marine community. And exactly 2 weeks after the attack on the Brillante, as he was still working to prove out these doubts, David climbed into his car outside his office in Yemen, turned the key, drove a short distance onto a busy road, and was killed by a bomb that had been placed under the driver's seat.
That the incident where, you know, David is killed from a bomb really starts to, you know, for some show that this is a dangerous situation, or perhaps I would say that when reading the book, it felt like, you know, it wasn't 100% sure at all that this was related to his look at the boat. Let's go a little bit into detail, because not only is there multi-layered levels of insurance, but there's also multi-layered levels of how ships run, are owned, who staffs them. You know, there's as we start to dig into this world, it is not as simple as, okay, this one person owns this ship, this is their crew. Can you go into that?
Yeah, that's one of the things, one of the mind-blowing things that we discovered when researching this book was how easy it is to own a ship and have no one know that you own it. It's like shipping is designed for anonymity. It is, in fact, designed for anonymity. That's the way the people who own ships like it. Most big commercial vessels these days are owned by single offshore companies, single ship companies, they're called. And they might be registered in the Marshall Islands, as the Brillante Virtuoso was. The shareholders in that shell company might be based in Cyprus. The ultimate owner of the vessel might be continents away and separated from publicly being identified with the ship by, you know, half a dozen layers of corporate obfuscation. And so even Lloyd's, which is, you know, the oldest shipping market that there is, has been in this game for hundreds of years. It's this huge, incredibly sophisticated financial organization. Even the members of Lloyd's don't often know who ultimately owns the ships they're insuring, which is a crazy thought when you consider the sums of money at stake not to know who you're doing business with. I mean, that should set alarm bells ringing, I think.
So Matthew, just as it said that all roads lead to Rome, it seems like all ships end up in Greece. Talk to us a little bit about how Greek nationals became so prominent in this world of multi-level ownership.
Well, this is a remarkable story that is kind of an inspiring tale of plucky entrepreneurship in some ways and of regulatory capture in others. So Greek ship owners are by far the most prolific force in the maritime world. Greece accounts for the better part of 20% of global shipping, which for a country that has about the population of Illinois and is not even in the top 20 economies in Europe is really quite something. And this developed after the Second World War, where there were some very canny Greek businessmen who built huge positions in shipping, initially by buying up cheap Liberty ships, which were going really for a song as the US Navy demobilized. And there were two in particular, Aristotle Anastas and Stavros Niarchos, who became totally dominant. And they were responsible, more than anyone else anyway, for the development of the supertanker, which was a huge, hugely important change in how oil and gas markets work. And they also developed the offshore structures that Kit was alluding to, single ship shell companies, what are called flags of convenience, where vessels fly the flag, nominally anyway, of Liberia, Panama, the Marshall Islands, these other very lightly regulated, very low cost jurisdictions. Niarchos and Onassis were the people who really figured that out. And that template was replicated again and again in Greece to the point where today Greece is by a huge margin the most important ship owning nation.
There's so much in this book that, you know, once you take just a little crumb, like you go in deeper, everything's a rabbit hole in some ways, whether it be the ownership, the insurance, what's happening on the vessel. It's well written. And so in come Richard Veal and Michael Connor. Can you tell us a bit about them and what their role in the investigation was?
Yes, Richard Veal and Michael Connor, I guess, are the sort of closest we have to the heroes of this story. In that they are ultimately the ones who really make a concerted effort to unravel the fraud. And also look at what happened to David Mockett. They are two former London police detectives. They speak with sort of Cockney accents. They swear profusely. They're great. They're like characters from a 70s cop show. And they quit the police force and got into this lucrative business of private investigations where lawyers and insurers will hire them to use their detective skills to get to the bottom of incidents that they need to understand better. So they were brought in to look at the Brillante Virtuoso case, and they ended up spending years and years and years pulling at threads, going all over the world, seeking out eyewitnesses. They had some remarkable scrapes along the way. And really, I think they're the ones who hold a good degree of the credit for ultimately, you know, what we know about the fraud that took place and how well we understand it now.
If Veal and Connor are the heroes of the book, I suppose the villain of the story would appear to be Marios Iliopoulos. Matthew, talk to us a little bit about this character who appears to have been involved in more than one fraudulent insurance claim.
So Mario Seliopoulos is a very prominent Greek ship owner. He got into the business through his father, who was a ship owner before him. And he owned the Brillante Virtuoso, although that was not apparent for the reasons Kit alluded to before. It took some time to figure out that Iliopoulos was, in fact, the owner. He also owned a vessel called the Ellie, which 2 years earlier, in a location not far from where the apparent pirate attack on the Brillante occurred, met a very unusual end, where it essentially split in half like a watermelon, which is something that maritime experts have assured me is quite difficult to have occur accidentally. And there was a great deal of suspicion in London about the nature of that accident. Ultimately, it ended up in court, but was settled out of court confidentially. And so when Marios was ultimately linked to the Brillante, and Richard Veal, the private investigator who'd been hired to get to the bottom of this, demonstrated that Iliopoulos was the owner, we have a scene in the book where someone says, you know, they almost fall off their chair because they say, that's the guy from the Ellie. He'd been known for this very mysterious event. And the Brillante then made his reputation even more colorful, certainly in the shipping world.
Well, one would think that given the evidence that points to the fact that this was, you know, a fraud, and I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that, and this would have been the second one, was the guy ever put in jail or prosecuted? Kit?
No one has ever been charged with a criminal offense, either related to the Brillante Virtuoso fraud or to the death of David Mockett. And that's really a sad consequence of the failings of law enforcement, the success of organized crime when it comes to shipping, and how successfully, you know, criminal gangs have infiltrated the world of maritime trade. And it's, you know, it's a desperate injustice. It's a frustrating one for David Mockett's family in particular. And I know that it absolutely enrages his widow, Cynthia Mockett, who has to watch all the people that she considers at least partially responsible for her husband's death carry on going about their business as normal.
And is there, Matthew, is there evidence that ultimately ties Iliopoulos to what happened here, either directly or indirectly?
In the case of the fraud, a judge in the High Court in London ruled in 2019 that the destruction of the Brillante Virtuoso was an insurance fraud, that the pirates who attacked it were hired actors, essentially, who'd been instructed to carry out a hoax pirate attack and in the process destroy the vessel. And the judge found very clearly that the person responsible for these events was Iliopoulos. So you have this extremely forceful civil ruling in a very important court in London, stating that this ship owner was responsible for the fraudulent destruction of a $100 million oil tanker. Nonetheless, there has never been, as Kit mentioned, there has never been any charges against Iliopoulos or anyone else involved in this. There have been criminal investigations in the UK and elsewhere, but none of them have ever gotten to the point of actual prosecution. And as of this moment, according to certainly the best information we have, all of those investigations are dormant.
With all the money that was at stake or is at stake during this, why has Lloyd's traditionally been so unwilling to aggressively take on this behavior? It almost felt like in the book that they weren't, you know, a driving force necessarily behind trying to find the answers. It felt like others maybe had more passion about this.
That's a really interesting question. And I think to understand it, you've got to really look at what Lloyd's is and what it does. Lloyd's is an internationally relevant and important finance institution, and its job is to be a sort of shock absorber for the world economy when things go terribly wrong. Lloyd's is there to absorb some of the damage. So it's vital that it does its job. But Lloyd's has also always been a source of wealth for its members. Insurance is a hugely lucrative business, always has been. And for a few hundred years, it's been a steady stream of income for the British upper and middle classes. In more recent years, it's been a fantastic source of income for multinational insurance corporations. And, you know, like all elite systems, the members of those systems are interested in preserving their power and their privilege. And they've done that very successfully right up until the present day. But, you know, unfortunately for everyone else, that means they're not particularly incentivized to face up to gangsters and criminals. It's their job to make money, and that's what they do. So the tendency at Lloyd's, and this has been true throughout history, is to look the other way, is to pay a bit of money to insurance claims that are probably dodgy. And that's made marine insurance really a perfect breeding ground for criminals.
And I take it that's because they think that if they look the other way this time, they're more likely to get the business the next time. In other words, that it's the preservation of the income flow that causes them to do this slightly corrupt approach to dodgy insurance claims. Is that fair, Matthew?
That's basically right. Lloyd's is a phenomenally profitable institution. For the most part, although there have been times where there have been exceptions to this, for the most part, Lloyd's insurers do extremely well. So paying out some questionable claims now and then doesn't have a huge impact on the bottom line. And yes, as you say, accusing your clients of fraud is not a great way to get them to come back next time. And something that came up periodically in the Brillante case, when insurers would be asked why they weren't fighting harder, why they weren't making a more serious effort to combat, you know, what was clear to a lot of people was fraud. The answer would be something like, well, we don't want to get a reputation for being difficult, or, you know, we don't want to get into messy legal situations that we're not sure that we can win and which are, of course, expensive. So the path of least resistance is often just to pay.
So you mentioned that Iliopoulos was never criminally prosecuted. This story obviously has some public information out there from your book and your articles, among other things. Is he still allowed to be engaged in international shipping after this clearly fraudulent scheme?
Yes, Super Mario, as he's known in Greece, appears to be doing just fine. He, during the COVID pandemic, a lot of the cruise liners went out of business, and he did a great trade in buying up cheap cruise vessels and selling them for three times as much, making millions of dollars by some estimations. We also managed to link him to a vessel that was sanctioned by the US authorities for breaking the embargo on Venezuelan oil. So, you know, he also remains the owner of SeaJets, which is one of the biggest commercial ferry companies in Greece. If you go on holiday to Mykonos and you take the fast ferry, there's a good chance you'll be on one of his vessels. And the craziest thing of all is that Marios Iliopoulos, at least indirectly, is still being insured through the Lloyd's system. They haven't cut him off. And I think that tells you, you know, more than anything Matt and I could write about how seriously Lloyd's takes these problems.
It does. We've been speaking with Matthew Campbell and Kit Shillel about their new book, Dead in the Water, A True Story of Hijacking, Murder, and a Global Maritime Conspiracy. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. Do you love Mountain Money? Let us know. Leave us a review.